Hello, and welcome to the podcast. When Rita Lashar left Radio 4's World Tonight earlier this year, I was cross. The programme had been a must-listen for me when Robin Lustig presented it. And when Rita Lashar took over 10 years ago as the main presenter, she proved to have the safest of hands, calm, authoritative and impartial. She has spent 35 years at the BBC as a producer on Today and then presenting The World Today, Woman's Hour and chairing Any Questions. She's still broadcasting, of course, but now on Classic FM, with a time slot opposite her old programme. Why did she leave? I was keen to find out, and also to hear what she thought of the BBC Today. Well, Rita Lashar, I hope I got the pronunciation right. I feel as if I know you very well since I, as it were, I spent my evenings with you, most evenings, for the last 10 years on The World Tonight, switching on. Of course, I don't think we've ever met. It must be very strange for you, however, now, not to be doing The World Tonight in the midst of the sort of conflicts that were, in a way, your bread and butter.
Absolutely. I felt very, very, very confused, in a way, about what's happening in the Middle East. My initial reaction was relief not to be covering it because it's so horrific. And for the first few days, I just thought, oh, you know, it's one thing to watch this as a viewer. It's another thing to be a journalist, absolutely embedded in the story. But as the days have gone by, the journalist in me has really kicked in and it does feel quite difficult to not be covering it. I admit that fully. I care passionately. And I do feel that this is possibly one of the most important things that has happened since 9/11. I think it's a world-changing event. And yes, to that extent, I really do wish I was covering it.
Well, and I hope to return to that in a moment. But at the moment, but you now, of course, have something which is the antithesis of that, which maybe people will turn to for relief late in the evening, 10 o'clock, I think, at Classic FM. How difficult has it been to adjust to that? Because the one is, you know, on that ball, up to the minute, and the other is, relax, it's Classic FM.
Do you know, I think I needed it. I think I had got to the point. We've had an extraordinary news cycle for the last, I don't know how long, certainly 5 or 6 years. I felt quite exhausted by it. And I think I'd got to the point where, rather than being excited by breaking news, I was beginning to feel quite stressed out by it. And I think as a journalist, you want to stand apart. You can't get too emotionally involved because if you do, you stop doing your job effectively. And I think I'd got to the point where it was all beginning to be a bit too much. And I really empathise with all the people who say, I don't watch the news, I don't listen to the news anymore, I can't bear it. I get it. It has been so intense. So there was a bit of me, in a way, this is the perfect antidote. It's the medicine I needed, perhaps.
Why did you leave the BBC, though? Because, look, I don't want to point this out too much, but you could technically be my daughter. So it's very early to move out the front line. Why did you do it?
There were lots of reasons. One was that exhaustion. I don't pretend otherwise. I felt really, it had been a very, very intense period for a very long time. But if you throw into that what's been happening at the BBC and what specifically happened to my programme, to The World Tonight, was the resources were getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and yet the news cycle was getting faster and faster and faster. And there were also times when I felt very exposed, when you didn't feel that you had the support that you needed to go on air. And if things went wrong, everyone's very quick to criticise the BBC, rightly. It takes public money. But that makes you feel very vulnerable. I found that extremely difficult. And I think it's changing as a place, probably for the better. I don't know. I'm not going to make a judgment on that, actually. It's changing. And I think it is a place that wants to attract younger people. And I felt at the other end of that age range, despite being young enough to be your daughter.
Yeah, well, heaven knows what I should feel like. But I mean, it's all that expertise and knowledge. And you could argue that actually, as resources get cut back, it's more important than the presenter. And the editor, of course, are intensely experienced and can, you know, sort out the wheat from the chaff. And also when claims are made in this propaganda war that goes on side by side with the obvious physical fighting, to spot things early. And you can't expect young people to be as alert to that as perhaps those who've had more experience. The other thing I wondered about also with you, though, is, and I know this from talking to somebody inside the BBC, is that you see stuff which comes in which is then censored, sanitized for the audience. But you see terrible, terrible things. When I used to be an editor a long time ago, I didn't give any thought to post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, I'm afraid as a man probably at that time, I would have thought, oh, come on, pull yourself together. But it is a real issue now. I mean, people in the newsroom are having to look at footage which is so horrific. I won't go into the details. And then, as it were, sanitize it for the viewer, but they can't get the images out of their heads.
I think that's definitely true. I have a former colleague who has now left the BBC who certainly talks about that at length. I can't say it was the worst for me. I work in radio, so the images we look at have probably already been filtered by our colleagues before they arrive on our desks in our computers when I was at the BBC. So that I'm certainly not doing the worst of that kind of work. I have colleagues who, you know, are paid to do that. That is their job. It's I can't pretend that any of that is enjoyable. You see it as your job. They talk, I think, about people having a cup which can be only so full and at some point it overflows. I'm not suggesting that I was anywhere near that, but I certainly began to feel that this was all becoming a bit too much. And, for everybody, that point is it will come at a different time. I'm not saying I wouldn't go back. I definitely would. I think journalism is a really important job, particularly when it's done in the forum like the BBC, where there is so much care and so much attention paid to trying to be fair, to trying to be impartial, despite what people may think. People are trying to do their job as well as they can. It's a brilliant place to work. But I think I did feel that it was time for me to perhaps stand apart for a while.
And when you listen and watch the coverage from the outside, do you worry about the BBC's impartiality at all, or do you see this as the inevitable consequence of opinionated people trying to influence the organisation in their direction?
Look, the BBC makes mistakes. It's a vast organisation churning out tons and tons of output. However, I absolutely defend the work of the journalists inside it. They're trying to do their best in really difficult circumstances. These people work incredibly hard in dangerous situations sometimes. They are trying to do their best. And yes, they do make mistakes, but it's not intentional. And people aren't setting out to be biased. I think that's, in a way, that's one of the hardest...
No, but the important thing is there is unconscious bias. That is, we all have an element of that we need to be aware of. There is groupthink, which is in danger. So constant self-examination is important, I think. But obviously recently, under the Director General, Tim Davie, and perhaps as a result of having to have a better relationship with the Conservative government, there's been this immense stress on impartiality, which does give the impression that there was a problem. Indeed, people have talked about there having been a problem. Do you think the BBC had a problem with impartiality?
I don't think the BBC had a problem with impartiality. I think the impartiality is problematic, and I think it's how we define it changes. I think it's surprising that Tim Davie chose to pin his colours to the mast on impartiality in quite the way he did, because it does imply that there was a problem. As I say, I would be the first to admit that the BBC doesn't always get things right, but it's not for want of trying. And I think there is a difference in how people view impartiality over the last so many decades. I'm not quite sure when it began, but the elision of news and opinion has moved apace. And I think there is a younger generation of journalists who view impartiality differently. They are culturally perhaps... They've grown up in a world where identity politics, cultural politics have influenced them, as they should. I mean, we don't live in a vacuum. Nobody lives in a vacuum. You're influenced by the events and the times that you grow up in. I think there's an older generation, in which I would firmly place myself, who are much more conscious of what it means to be impartial in perhaps a more old-fashioned way. I'm not quick to...
I wonder whether this has always been the case, though. I remember Mark Thompson when he was... Sir Mark Thompson, from my former researcher, when he was Director General, saying, when I worked on Nationwide, when I was his editor, there wasn't anybody who wasn't sort of left-wing among younger people. And I took him to task a bit about that. But I think that's... young people tend to be more left, more liberal. But then, you know, editors tended to be a bit more experienced, presenters a little bit older. And there was a natural sort of tension and backwards and forwards between the two. And there was this, you know, we did take the public service shilling, didn't we? And we promised to try and be impartial. And there was a good argument going. So I think it's always been an issue, this age question. But I think you're probably right. It has got worse in the period of social media, where young people are so used to having a view when they come into an organisation. Actually, and also thinking they should campaign and thinking in a way history is on their side, that can be dangerous. But then, you know,
it's a question I've had to ask myself over the years. There are occasions when you feel, is silence in a way traducing the idea of impartiality, the fact that you haven't spoken out on something?
Oh, yes.
Does that make you, in some people's eyes, partial in a different direction?
Oh, yes, there's partiality by the choice of the agenda. But to, as you know from running orders, you put one thing on in, you have to take another thing out.
Absolutely. So I don't think it's easy to nail down what it means to be impartial. The way I used to test myself was, am I seeing this issue in the round? You know, these are my opinions. I won't try, will try very hard not to share them with you. This is where I'm coming from. But what's the other point of view? And what are the other ways of thinking about this? It's not whataboutism. It's not on the one hand, on the other hand. But it is standing in the middle and doing a 360 degree turn and trying to think about all the ways in which one could consider an issue and trying to reflect them in a measured and proportionate way. Some views clearly outweigh others, but how do you determine that? And as I say, I'm not suggesting that everybody gets it right all the time, but it is something that people work really hard at.
And I notice you're still obviously very interested because you now join RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. Why did you do that?
Because I think defence and security, as the events of the last 3 weeks have shown, are clearly rising issues in our time. If we talk about the rise of China, North Korea, there is so much that is changing. A multipolar world necessarily means that the way in which we view defence and security has to change. America, as a superpower, is being challenged in all kinds of ways. I think it's never been more important to think about these issues than it is now. It's happening as we speak, and I'm really grateful to be plugged in to people who are working on this sort of all the time and doing really important work, really difficult work. Work also actually that is made easier by the fact that we now have open source journalism, open source information that's available to everybody. If you think about the build up to the Ukraine war, the fact that there were people who were able to see the build up of Russian troops in real time before there was any real, you know, before we knew there was an invasion. Those sort of things are so important, and there are people working on it, and I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to speak to them and at least be part of what they're doing. I think it's an enormously important bit of work.
Just before we leave the question of the world tonight and so on, did you get a bit irritated in radio? I did, frankly, when the audiences were often twice that of equivalent programmes in television, and the budgets were, well, I don't know, a tenth or something else. I mean, I can't understand how Radio 4 allowed itself to be cut and cut and cut when it was so successful. Or perhaps that's the truth. If something's successful, it doesn't attract new resources. And if they're struggling, programmes or, you know, programmes directed at young people get more money.
It was really frustrating, and it was certainly one of the things that in the end made me think, you know, I can't be the person that keeps making this work. Radio 4 in particular, and the sequence programmes, what we call the sequence programmes, I still say we, do you notice that? What they call the sequence programmes, so Today, The World at 1pm and The World Tonight, extraordinarily successful programmes, still have huge audiences, but over the years they've all had quite significant cuts. The World Tonight was the first and was slashed, really. And it has been frustrating because I would say that the influence of those programmes has been over the years disproportionate. The audiences that listen to them, I suspect, are the ones that are happily paying their licence fee, and I feel they're being shortchanged. And on The World Tonight, compared to my colleagues on Newsnight, and I really respect them, I think they do brilliant work. It's not a criticism of the content, but a frustration with the fact that as their audiences plummeted to below what The World Tonight's were, their budgets really didn't. And I found that really, really frustrating. There had to be a way to preserve the fantastic work that was being done on Newsnight, but without it being this dominant feature of news in a way that, well, at the expense of others, it was frustrating. I mean, it was frustrating that we were, in a way, the sacrificial lambs, despite the fact that our audiences were steady and we were doing well. And as I say, that's not to criticise the content of Newsnight or my colleagues. It was just odd the way in which those decisions were made.
But the cuts have gone on. But the thing that is, I think, the biggest danger, or it seems to be the biggest danger, is the agenda narrows. That the BBC sustained its ability to analyse the existing agenda, but it's a narrowing agenda determined by others. You expand their agenda by having your reporters do original investigations and say, hey, this may not be a matter of debate now, but look at this. I mean, let's look at what we're hearing at the moment about the COVID inquiry. What is absolutely clear is that the whole of the governmental system was not prepared for this. Now, a Newsnight programme or a World Tonight programme that got ahead of the game and pointed that out is what we needed. And they can only do that if the programmes have the confidence to go off the immediate agenda and say, we know this is important, it may not be discussed now, but we will place it on the agenda. It's much more difficult to do that if you don't have reporters.
I couldn't agree more. And reporters are resource, and they've actually been in the front line of what's gone. When I joined The World Tonight, we had two reporters and they were cut. The reporters on all the other Radio 4 programmes were cut. Now, you can argue that perhaps they weren't being used effectively, but that's a different question to whether they were needed or not. And I think the centralisation of reporting in the way that it has been carried out by the BBC makes sense on paper. I can see that it's cheaper. You're getting people to work from a centralised pool. But what it doesn't do is allow for a pooling of ideas and for that kind of creativity that you need sometimes from individuals thinking, this is important. I can see this coming down the track, taking the decision quickly and deploying. And I think that is going to be a weakness. And I think if you're going to talk about public service broadcasting, and I would argue we don't talk about those three words enough, then I think that's crucial. That's something the BBC can do that other people are finding it harder and harder to do.
Can we go back then to the sort of beginning of your career? You've called yourself, self-confessed, anorak. So what was it like from your background looking at the BBC? I mean, my mother said to me, you know, she desperately wanted me to be a solicitor, or she wanted me to have some other profession. Didn't want me to be a journalist. But actually, if I was going to be a journalist, well, the BBC was all right. What about, did you always want to be a journalist and always a BBC journalist?
So I can claim a similar story. All those sort of stereotypes of Asian parents sadly are true. So my parents wanted me to be some kind of professional. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. And I am the youngest in the family. An awful lot of effort was put in by the whole family for me to have sort of a top-notch education. So there was a lot of expectation. I loved radio from the time I can remember. It was my constant companion. I did student radio, and so it was such a sort of, it was a dream. But my friends at university were like, well, why can't you work in radio? And to which my answer was, well, people like me don't work in radio, you know, small brown women. Why would I work in radio? And I wasn't at all sure that my parents would approve. I was very, very lucky in that I got a job as a researcher at the BBC before I graduated, which was a sort of extraordinary, really, bit of luck. A bit of chutzpah as well on my part, I admit. But anyway, I did get this job. So my parents then, well, we were like, well, you've got a job. OK, fine, go and do this job. My father died more than 20 years ago, but he was a sort of quite a hard person to please. But he was so proud of me because, as you suggest, your mother was. I worked for the BBC. That was something he understood and he valued and saw as really, really important. So all's well that ends well, I guess.
going back then to when you joined the BBC at the end of the 1980s, did you feel very isolated as a woman with brown skin? As I remember, back then there weren't that many around.
Yes and no. Yes, I was pretty much the only one. I think Rita Chakrabarty and I knew each other, and I think she was about in those days. But it was a very different world. I think one thing that probably helped me was I was used, and this this actually sounds really awful, but I was used to being often the only woman, the only brown person in a room because of lots of the choices I'd made. So in that sense, the BBC was the same. There were many people who were kind to me, but yes, it was, you stood out. And I think an incident that illustrates how I stood out really well was I was a producer on the Today programme, and you were often asked as part of that job to go and work at Westminster for a few weeks with all the political reporters, so the political coverage. And I was there doing that job, and I was sent to a press conference in Westminster. So this would have been the very early 1990s. And I remember walking into the room, and for a split second, there was absolute silence as everyone turned to look at me. That room was essentially full of men. There were very few women in Westminster in those days, and certainly no brown people. And this whole room turned to look at me, kind of, oh, what's she doing here? And then carried on. And there were moments like that when I really, really felt painfully aware of the fact that I was different. But I think the thing that helped me survive was my experience at university, where my friends had been extraordinarily supportive and kept saying, why not you? Why can't you work in radio if that's what you really love? And I think that really carried me through.
But did you feel you had to be a role model, that people, you know, you had to represent, as it were, all brown women, that if you did something wrong, then a whole section of society would be sort of categorised or denigrated by that?
Yes, on some level, but I think I felt like that all my life, that I always had to be a bit better than everybody else, and that was a responsibility. However, I also regret the fact that I perhaps didn't push as hard as I might have on behalf of other people. Perhaps my very presence in some way was part of that, but I feel I could have, there are causes I could have fought more fiercely than I did. I think other people did that after me, and I slightly regret that I didn't push harder. But yes, I did feel like a role model. But one positive story, actually, out of all of that, is when I started presenting on Radio 4 some years later, on a number of occasions, complete strangers that I would meet at events would come up to me when they worked out who I was and say, I'm so pleased you're on Radio 4. It means so much to me that you're there because I feel like you represent me. I had never expected that. I do think that kind of representation matters. I wish I'd fought a little bit harder for other people than I did actively fought, as opposed to just being there.
Well, it's a wonderful thing and a burden at the same time. But let me to move on to something else, which is when you discovered, as the rest of us discovered, that women presenters in BBC News tended to be paid very significantly less than men, even though their ultimate bosses were often women. Now, I was shocked by this. You must have been more than shocked, weren't you?
It's a really painful episode in my life, Roger, which I still can't quite get over, even though it is now behind me. So I discovered during the course of the equal pay kind of row that I was paid in the tens of thousands when all my colleagues were paid in the hundreds of thousands. Now, there are two separate issues there. One is, yes, I was paid like vastly lower than my colleagues. I'm talking about my colleagues who were presenters on radio. We're not talking about correspondents, not talking about celebrities, you know, that appear on light entertainment programmes.
And we're not talking about either on people who present television news programmes. You're talking about radio specifically.
Yes. I mean, if you bring television into it, it gets even worse. But I was really shocked. I was paid. I went around asking everyone that I possibly could what they were paid, people who I thought would answer me. I couldn't find a single person who was doing a comparable job to me, so regularly presenting a news programme, who was paid less than I was.
So it wasn't that you felt you were underpaid, it's that you felt, on the whole, quite a few of your male presenters were overpaid.
I really firmly believe, and perhaps this explains why I was so badly underpaid, because I didn't fight my own corner, perhaps. If you work in news as a journalist, you don't go into it for the money. There are lots of ways you can make lots of money if that's what you want to do. You should be going into it because you want to make the world a better place. You want to find out things. You want to search under stones. And I think that many of my colleagues are rather overpaid. I'm going to make exceptions to that. For instance, I think Waking up at 3 a.m. and presenting the Today programme is possibly the hardest job in broadcasting. I think if you're a correspondent on the front line, and I'm not talking about them really, but if you are a correspondent on the front line, those are dangerous jobs. By all means, pay people. But it's a privilege to do the job that I used to do. It was astonishing. You got to speak to amazing people. I was learning all my life. So my objections at the end of all of this were not... Yes, I was paid vastly less than my peers. That seemed to me just unfair within that context. But then standing back and looking at the issue as a whole, not quite sure why lots of us were paid as much as we were. By all means, pay people well. It's a difficult job, but it's also a privilege. And I don't think you should go into news because you think you're going to get rich.
Well, maybe you were, I don't know, usual explanations of this are men are more pushy or inbuilt bias. But I say, I come back to that problem that by the time you were in your, certainly presenting The World Tonight, BBC News was run by a woman, the women right around the top. They did nothing to rectify this situation until it was exposed by Samira Ahmed and others. I mean, I still don't understand that. Do you know why that would
I
be?
Don't.
Why they wouldn't have pushed that to the front of their concerns?
I don't understand. I'm not sure I'll ever understand. There must have been tens, if not, well, there must have been more than 10 managers who saw what I earned and the fact that nobody chose to at least raise it as a concern amongst themselves to say, oh, her pay is so out of line with everybody else. How can that be right? I really can't explain it. I think, like with so much with the BBC, I often think it's not about people actively trying to be mean. It's a kind of benign neglect. It's people not thinking things through. It's such a big organisation that people don't look at the bigger picture. They look at the individual thing. I'm not sure that explains it or excuses it either, really. I think it's awful. It was, and it does make you then...
But the past few years, I suppose, and this is no defence, but I suppose the past few years have been essentially cutting budgets, programmes, budgets being cut back. The prospect while you're doing that of then paying some of the existing staff more, maybe that was more difficult. Maybe that explains some of the reluctance in the last few years to face this problem. But still, it's there, and it shouldn't have been there, and it was systemic.
Well... It came home to roost in a horrific way. And the one last thing about that is the differential between those who present programmes and those who make them, the journalists, the producers, who are, you know, really working hard. It's vast and I think unfair.
Amen to that. You're obviously not, in personal terms, particularly pushy. I mean, you have to be a bit pushy to do the job you were doing, but... You're not that pushy, but you're certainly private. I mean, when one tries to find out lots of things about your private life, is she married, is she not, whatever, you can't find it. You've never pushed your family forward. I mean, you are married, you have children, but you've never pushed your family forward. It was that deliberate. You've never accepted invitations, as far as I can see, to be on the front page of a glossy magazine.
It is deliberate in the sense that I am a private person. And one of the things that I have always loved about radio is it enables you to be a voice on air, but you can be a completely anonymous person walking down the street. It's very different from television in that way. And I also feel that it's... As a journalist, you want to be... Or as a broadcast journalist, you want to be a cipher for the people who are listening. I'm there representing you in some sense. And the less you know about me, the more I can be you. I think the more you know about me, the more assumptions you make about what I may think, what I may say, what I may believe. And if you're going to be impartial, or at least attempt to be impartial, it's quite helpful for people to not know those things about you. And I found this move into social media, which puts a lot of pressure on you to reveal things about yourself, I found that really difficult. And if anything, now I've left the BBC, that's going to be even worse, because if you have an organisation as strong as the BBC beside you, you can, in a way, make the choice to remain private. I'm not sure I will have that option going forward. And yes, I do find that difficult.
Well, but you now have the opportunity, maybe, of being available to Strictly Come Dancing. Any chance you would, if asked, would you serve?
I have 2 left feet, but never say never.
Oh, we'd get on well on the dance floor then. Anyway, you've left the BBC with a big wrench. Lo and behold, you ended up in hospital briefly as well, so it's been quite a summer. But now you're at Classic FM. Did you have to learn how to be a presenter on Classic FM? I mean, you've got the voice, you've got so many of the skills, but is there a separate sort of skill set you need for that programme?
It's a separate side of yourself in a way. I really love it because you're able to reveal a softer side of your personality. And I really, really like that. I really like the fact that I've kind of had this career where I've been this reasonably sort of stern, serious person. And I am that. But I'm also lighthearted, funny, kind of soft, a bit soppy. And it's quite nice to be able to indulge in some of that and reveal some of that. And it is a lovely programme to present. I do enjoy the music. I can't possibly, you know, you can't possibly complain about 3 hours of really lovely, calm, classical music every night. So it is a slightly different skill, but I think if you're a broadcaster, it shouldn't be. It's a change of gear rather than a complete change of vehicle and road, if that makes sense.
And instead of bringing disaster to people, you bring pleasure and in some cases even joy, which must be a lovely thing to do. But finally, what? Yeah, I mean, you someday you'll come back to news and current affairs. I mean, you're that sort of animal. This I hope is a long. I hope it's a pause for you. But you don't rule out coming back into the hurly burly of news and current affairs, do you?
No, definitely not. I love news. I really care about what happens in the world. I want people to understand. I want people to understand why news matters. It really matters to me, so I'm not suggesting that I've turned my back on it. But for now, I think this pause is a good one for me, for me personally, for my mental health. But I really, really do value news. I think it's important. I really admire my colleagues who carry on doing that important work. And I will be back in some shape or form, I hope.
Well, it's excellent news. And for listeners who want both The World Tonight and Rita LaShaw's classic FM programme, you can get both, although you have to miss the first bit of her programme.
Oh, no, I wouldn't recommend you do that.
That's in the contract. OK, Rita LaShaw, thank you very much.
Roger, thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. You'll be able to find my take on this week's interview and interviewee in my weekly blog. You can access this by signing up to Patreon at patreon.com/Beebwatch. It's less than a cup of coffee per month at £1.99. You can find the link on our website and in the description of this programme on your podcast platform. Please do support our journalism and tell us what you think of it. And if you didn't know already, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and is produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Until next time, goodbye.